to tell you about something that happened to me about a dozen years ago. I had a laboratory that came in and said, we can measure factors in the urine and we can identify imbalances in neurotransmitters and neuroactive peptides in the brain. And I was kind of puzzled by that claim because I always thought that if you wanted to find out what was going on in the brain, you had to look at the brain. I don't know about what happens in other clinics, but we don't do a lot of brain biopsies at my clinic. So we found out that, yeah, they sure had done some great research that indicated that you could use the urine to measure the factors of mood. And just to bring you up to speed, the neurotransmitters are chemicals that are released from a neuron, the end of a nerve in your brain, into this little tiny gap called a synapse. They cross the synapse where they can be accepted by the next neuron at a specialized site called a receptor. And then that action affects a whole lot of things you do, but it certainly affects your mood. You know, these neurotransmitters were discovered less than 100 years ago. An Austrian scientist woke up from a dream and came up with the idea of looking at these signaling mechanisms that were going on in animals. And when we look at these signaling messages, we know that they very much regulate our mood. And so when this laboratory said we could look at urine and tell what the chemicals were that were coming out of the brain that have to do with your mood, I said, well, what are you talking about treating? And it turned out it was the gamut of expression, from anxiety to depression, from hyperactivity to low energy, from lack of motivation to poor focus and concentration. Well, I'd be hard-pressed to find anybody that I interviewed in a clinical setting or in a casual setting that doesn't say, there are times when I feel depressed, there are times that I feel anxious, there's times when I have a lack of focus and concentration. But if you look at the amount of pharmaceuticals that are being used in the United States now to mediate mood, you know that it's more than just random chance. Neuroscientists have really begun to look at all of these chemicals that relate our mood and begin to modify them. And that started back in 87 with a drug called Prozac. You know, that was really a miracle for those of us that were in the field, and I can understand why physicians who were practicing in the 1940s considered penicillin a miracle. Prior to the development of penicillin, one out of every two people who got pneumonia died. Today, that's a very rare event, at least in this country. And so when this first drug, this first mood mediator was released into the marketplace, there were individuals. I was living in Colorado at the time, and I knew a woman who didn't come out of her room. She didn't comb her hair. She wouldn't participate with her family at all. And she began taking this drug that affects your neurotransmitters, specifically the neurotransmitter called serotonin. And within 10 days, she was sitting at the family table having dinner and chatting. And so it was easy for me to see this as a miracle. But those of you that are regular listeners to No Nonsense Nutrition know I'm inherently suspicious of pharmaceuticals because there are there are very few pharmaceuticals that have been delivered that are really designed to alleviate the problem long term. Very many of the pharmaceuticals are designed for you to take them forever and ever. They don't really want to cure you, because if they cure you, well, then you quit taking the compound. So the best thing to do is to find something that moderates whatever your condition is so that you will stay on that remedy forever and they can keep selling it to you. Well, when this laboratory presented this idea to me, I asked him how many tests they had done thus far, and they said 25,000. And I said I didn't think that was a big enough sample, and for them to come back and talk to me again after they had done 100,000 tests, which they did. And then I began using these tests in my practice, and I found out that the neurotransmitter chemical messengers of the central nervous system could be altered. You know, there's over 50 substances that are recognized as neurotransmitters, not all of them affecting the brain directly. But the classic neurotransmitters are the ones we're going to talk about. They're the ones that are involved in neuropsychiatry. And they include things that you've likely heard of, like serotonin and dopamine. And maybe ones that you've heard much less about, like catecholamines and GABA and glutamate or acetylcholine that we know is involved in memory and in Alzheimer's disease. You know, there's lots of metabolic processes that are involved in the synthesis and in the release of these neurotransmitters. But, you know, I'm going to start right away with our understanding that these neurotransmitters are proteins. And a protein is a collection of amino acids. And every protein, whether you're talking about turkey or chicken, every protein food has a slightly different collection of amino acids. That's one of the reasons that chicken and turkey taste different, why beef and lamb taste different, why grouper and swordfish taste different. So these amino acids in the proteins get broken apart in our digestion. And I liken it to a paragraph filled with a lot of words and those words made of letters. Your body in digestion eats that paragraph or that protein and breaks it down into words or peptides and then further breaks those words down into letters or amino acids. And then we use those amino acids to reconfigure other proteins in our body. And so it turns out that we can make indirect measurements through the urine of what's going on in these neurochemical processes. Even though measuring the blood and measuring the urine are inaccurate reflections of what's actually happening in the neurons, we could only measure them directly if we did that brain biopsy, but they are able to help us get a better understanding of what's going on in the body, because we've been able to relate symptoms to these levels and extrapolate that information enough that we know how to begin to treat. And so I'd like to spend some time today introducing you to those compounds, because half of what happens in my clinical practice is conversation about people's mood, people's ability to deal with the world. Every time you turn on the news, every time you open the paper, it's not necessarily going to be good. When we hear the stories of what's happening in the world, when we hear the threats from climate or the threats from other countries or the threats from our own economic stability, it shakes us. And it shakes us in a way that, you know, we still have to manage to blast through our day, but oftentimes it affects our focus and concentration. It affects our sleep. We end up with fatigue or anxiousness, with low mood or headaches. Our memory is affected. And what we often don't realize is that those same things can affect our cravings. They can affect our gut and how our gut works. They can be related to any of the persistent or reoccurrent symptoms that happen that we don't like of what's going on in our body. And so as we navigate the maze that it takes to get to optimal health, we want to look at the idea of these neurological imbalances, because imbalances in the nervous system not only affect the nervous system, they also can affect the hormone system, known as the endocrine system, and they can also affect immune function. You know, we know that if we have emotional stress, it's going to affect our nervous system, and that in turn will affect our neurotransmitters. But we don't often realize that that emotional stress will affect both our hormones and our inflammatory markers that are known as cytokines, the things that balance our immune system. Equally, we can have something happen on the physical side, not a psychological root cause, but a physical root cause, such as having an infection or having an allergic reaction. And that causes us to have highly inflamed tissue, which manufactures these compounds, neurotransmitters called cytokines, and they in turn activate the nervous system and the hormone system. So put that together in a triangle. And on one apex of the triangle, you have the nervous system. On one corner of the triangle, you have the endocrine or the hormone system. And on the third corner of the triangle, you have the immune system. What I want you to see is that there is a neuro-endo-immune connection that happens in the body. And it doesn't make any difference where the cascade begins. What's the first domino that falls? Do you have an allergic reaction and then that makes you depressed? Do you have some kind of shock in your life and that affects your hormones? It doesn't make any difference where you come in to that triangle. All systems are affected by the other systems. And optimal health is really only possible when the nervous system, the endocrine system, and the immune system are in balance. And when imbalances occur, whether it's a result of a psychological challenge or a physical challenge, we have upset the equilibrium. And so what I want us to understand here is that all three systems of the body are affected no matter what the stressor is. And if that activation is continuous, if that trauma is continuous, or that infection or allergen or, you know, toxic reaction is continuous, then imbalances are going to occur. You know, one of the questions that I ask people when they come into my practice is, when was the last time you felt really well? Because it's not uncommon to be able to trace back somebody's cascade downward to a single event. A single event of injury, a single event of shock, a single event of an allergic reaction. You know, I talk about the client that came to me and she said, every February I get so moody, I must have seasonal affective disorder, which is a shortage of light. We know that if you don't get enough light coming into your eye, it affects your pineal gland, and that lack of sunlight causing the condition called SAD, SAD, or seasonal affective disorder, is very common for people who live in, you know, New York and Maine and Ohio and Alaska. But in fact, what I realized was the reason that she got SAD but did not have seasonal affective disorder in February is that is one of our peak allergy months. You know, the allergies start hot and heavy here as we move toward the end of January. I don't know what's going to happen this year because we've had so little rainfall. You know, we're down 16 inches of rain from 2011, and so it's going to alter the blooming season this year. But generally speaking, February is when we have the issues with pine and oak and even cedar. And so it turned out that the reason that her mood spiraled downward during February was because she was having an allergen response. And so that allergen response in turn upregulated her inflammatory markers, and that in turn affected her neurotransmitters. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where we have a tendency to put everything in a box. We love to make categories. We love to take mental health issues and put them in one box and separate that out from immune issues and separate that out from endocrine issues. But in fact, all of those things are in the same body, in your body. And so if we want to improve, any one of those systems. We can start at any other of the systems to improve it. But when I look at the number of people that are taking antidepressants and are taking various kinds of medications because their mood is affected, then I want to bring to your attention that we can use simple compounds to elevate that mood. And I'm going to start out with my absolute favorite and the one that I probably use the most in my practice, which is my good old buddy 5-HTP. 5-HTP is the supplement that you can buy at any health food store that affects the transport and release of the neurotransmitter called serotonin. Now, probably everybody's heard of serotonin today because they know that antidepressants work on that particular pathway. But what they don't realize is that when you take these drugs that affect the serotonin pathway, they don't actually help you make more serotonin. They just take the serotonin that you do make and recycle it. Well, I've done over 1,600 neurotransmitter tests now, and what I've learned as a result of those neurotransmitter tests is low serotonin is the single most common thing that I see. When I measure 8 or 12 neurotransmitters, that consistently comes in as the most affected value. And so it's really easy to raise our serotonin levels. We can do so with the amino acid tryptophan, always an L in front of it because it's an amino acid, L-tryptophan. L-tryptophan can change into a number of different compounds, but one of them is 5-HTP or 5-hydroxytryptophan. It's a pretty inexpensive supplement. It's usually sold in 100 milligram doses. And we can take one of those 5-HTPs before we go to bed at night, and it will actually help us stay in restful sleep. 5-HTP really can only convert into one other compound, and that is serotonin. And serotonin, by the way, is the bucket from which the body derives the sleep hormone melatonin. So the pathway goes like this. Tryptophan turns into 5-HTP, 5-HTP turns into serotonin, and serotonin turns into melatonin. When we use 5-HTP, and I always begin with one at bedtime or half an hour before bedtime, I have individuals that take 5-HTP when they get up in the morning. But if you wanted an easy way to look at mood management, trying 100 milligrams of 5-HTP would be a way that you could make an effect. And make an effect that was simple, and make an effect that was safe. And generally speaking, within a matter of days, somebody is going to feel a lifting of their mood because this serotonin is available in the synapse. The very specific receptors that use it are going to be happy because they're going to get what they need, and you will have a mood lifting effect. But, you know, depression is a really big word. There are some individuals whose depression is quite profound. And a lot of depression is circular thinking. It's perusing and being pensive about something and just going around and around and around and not coming up with a new answer. And I say that midnight or that moonlight walk out in Myakka is probably the best therapy for you at that point, because I never see anything more powerful in lifting somebody's mood than putting them out into nature. You know, the second of the neurotransmitters that I see huge, big differences with as we use amino acid therapy is the work that's done to reduce anxiety. Anxiety is the second most common complaint that I get in my practice about mood, and anxiety comes from a degree of chronic stress. Again, all of us have stress. there's positive stress and negative stress. The way I differentiate them is positive stress is something that, you know, you got a radio show to do at 9 o'clock on Monday morning, and you've got some positive stress because you need to get it ready. And then there's negative stress, the constant barrage of the news, the difficulty that's going on in the family, the financial responsibilities. But the stress response is under the control of the sympathetic nervous system. And I have to tell you, there's nothing very sympathetic about the sympathetic nervous system. And so a whole lot of systems respond to that. Our adrenal glands and their hormones respond to it. Various neurotransmitters respond to stress. But in the early stage, we can have a chronic stress response. And when that happens, the excitatory neurotransmitters, what I call the gas pedals, all go up. People are agitated. They're alert. They don't sleep. They're ramped up. And so neurotransmitters like cortisol, hormones like DHEA, you know adrenaline, you may not know noradrenaline, or you may not know the other names for adrenaline like epinephrine and norepinephrine. Those things all go up when we have an early stage stress response. But when that stress goes on and goes on and goes on, we start getting depletion. And cortisol and epinephrine or adrenaline levels start to drop. And that's where we're going to begin to see people waking up in the morning pooped. They don't feel like they rested, even though they stayed in bed for 8 or 9 hours. They're still dragging, and that will happen when cortisol starts to drop. And, you know, ultimately, if we have stress that is long-term, it just keeps going and it keeps going, we get kind of numb to it. And so as we move to an end-stage stress response, we get kind of blasé. You know, we don't really, you know, pay a whole lot of attention anymore. We're kind of flat. Our mood is down because all the cortisol receptors have been desensitized. They've had so much cortisol poured on them that the receptors actually stop working well because they can't take that stress all the time. And then we will see these same neurotransmitters start to be chronically low. Cortisol, DHEA, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and serotonin will all be low, indicating the body has exhausted its ability to respond to the chronic stress. We know that chronic stress is related to cardiac disease. We know it's related to stroke. And there are biochemical interventions that we can do because these synthesizing pathways that we have for making neurotransmitters can be affected. And one of the ways that we can affect that chronic stress is to look at the use of the compound called L-theanine. L-theanine is an amino acid, and it is the precursor for the compound called GABA, which in and of itself is an amino acid. GABA is the brake pedal. It's one of the preeminent brake pedals in the body. And so when we use theanine, theanine has a tendency to reduce anxiety. I spoke about it with a client who was so wired when he came into my office that I actually gave him a theanine while he was sitting there just to get him calmed down enough that I could listen to his report. So serotonin to lift the mood, theanine to quiet anxiety. Again, two very safe interventions to affect mood. But, you know, I have to go through a very big list of these small molecule neurotransmitters and amino acids and what are called neuroactive peptides. All of these things can affect the brain. And the third one that really I put a lot of attention on in my practice is dopamine. Dopamine is one of the gas pedals. And it not only has to do with emotion, dopamine also has to do with muscle coordination. And that's why you might have heard about dopamine and its relationship to Parkinson's disease. Dopamine is involved in learning. It's involved in our working memory. And it is synthesized from the amino acid tyrosine in a whole series of steps. And so brain tyrosine levels are designed to help the brain make more dopamine. There's a couple of different kinds of dopamine receptors, but fundamentally, when we use the amino acid tyrosine, tyrosine not only increases our dopamine and helps us to be more coordinated muscularly, it helps us to make more dopamine so that our working memory and our learning is better. I have a client who's a graduate student over at USF right now, and she takes a tyrosine every morning before she goes to class because she says that it helps her learn. But because there is a tremendous need for dopamine in terms of our sense of feeling good, it's a pleasure and reward center. And so when I see individuals that have cravings, whether they have cravings for alcohol or drugs or food, I have a client currently, and she was doing an eat-a-thon as soon as she came home from work, where she would eat something and 20 minutes later she'd want something else, and 20 minutes later she'd want something else. Well, it's real easy for us to look at that and see that it is related to sugar balance. That is one of the signs that indicate that she is beginning on the diabetic pathway with a condition called insulin resistance. So when we have appetite and, you know, we have a cookie and 20 minutes later we want a cracker and 20 minutes later we want something else, then we always have to look at blood sugar first. But we didn't really get an effect from her from moderating that blood sugar until such time as we put in that amino acid tyrosine to raise her dopamine levels, because dopamine is our pleasure and satisfaction neurotransmitter. And so when we have good dopamine, we feel good about the world. We feel good about how our life works. When we have adequate dopamine, we still want more dopamine because we like how it makes us feel. There have been really remarkable rat studies that have been done that will show that the rat will continue to press that pedal to get that little jolt of dopamine in the brain over and over and over again, to the point that the rat could starve itself to death just to get more dopamine because it feels so good. So the reason that we smoke cigarettes is because of dopamine. I use the tyrosine amino acid for individuals who want to quit smoking cigarettes, because when we raise dopamine, then they don't have to be using nicotine to do it. Having low dopamine is very common in individuals who have a problem with just drinking too much alcohol. And I want to say that, yes, there is a difference between people who just want to drink too much alcohol and alcoholics. When we put in more dopamine, that pleasure and satisfaction, that experience in the brain is improved. And as a result, people aren't looking to feel better as a result of drinking. So it doesn't make any difference whether it's snacking or tobacco or drinking. Dopamine is always going to be involved. And dopamine is virtually always going to be involved anytime we are looking at paranoia or looking at hallucinations, looking at some of the things that show up with schizophrenia. I'm not a psychotherapist. I don't want to feign that I am a psychotherapist, but there have been so many easy ways to mediate some of these feelings with these amino acids that I think that it's inappropriate to only put people through talking therapy. I've had people in my practice that have come in that have been in some sort of psychotherapy, some sort of talking therapy, whether it's cognitive behavioral work or Jungian work or any other kind of analysis. And I've seen that they could be in that therapy for 5, 10, even 15 years, but they're not really more functional. They're more knowledgeable about their condition. They know that their, you know, aunt was a weirdo and their second grade teacher was a Nazi and their, you know, toilet training was poor and, you know, all of these things affected who they became as they grew up, but they're not really more functional. But when we put the amino acids in, then their brains, their hungry brain, starts to respond more normally. And as a result of that, they feel better, they behave better, and their lives are more fulfilled. And so dopamine and its receptors can be very much adversely affected by environmental toxins. We know that environmental toxins can swamp these dopamine receptors and even deactivate some of the dopamine receptors and create symptoms that are really indistinguishable from Parkinson's disease. I had a client a number of years ago who had the bug spray people come into the house, and for 48 to 100 hours or so after the bug spray people came into the house, she would have tremors. Her hand would shake. Her head would vibrate. She said she felt like somebody was beating a drum inside of her body. And when I suggested to her that the pesticides might be doing that, she thought that was a long shot until such time as she kept a calendar and discovered that the 2 to 4 days every month that she got those symptoms were always the 2 to 4 days following the pesticide exposure. But even when she discontinued the use of those toxic pesticides inside her home, she had residual effects. She no longer had the 2 to 4 days of tremors, but she had residual effects because those receptor sites in her brain had been affected, and it took quite a bit of detoxification work in order to get her back on board. You know, I warn constantly here on No Nonsense Nutrition about the inherent dangers of pesticides and the fact that these chemicals are not even remotely safe for us to be exposed to. And when we continue to be exposed to them, especially in our home, the connection to the neurological system is really profound, and we can expect a downturn. You know, we know that Parkinson's disease is highest in landscapers and farm workers and in individuals who are preparing the ground for putting in a new residence. They spray the ground with, you know, anti-termite kinds of compounds. And so all of the neuroimmune crosstalk that happens where your nervous system and your immune system talk to each other are mediated by the compounds that are affected by pesticides. And so there are non-toxic pesticides that are available for use both in your home and in your lawn. But if you're getting one of those big chemical companies to deliver poison directly to your door every day, just so you have a pretty green lawn, or just so you never have anything walking around your house, just remember, you're a living thing and you're also walking around your house. And so all of those protein messengers that are coming from those pesticides are doing some really nasty things to multiple systems, not just the sympathetic nervous system, but the immune responses as well as the hormonal responses. We've talked many times about the fact that pesticides are endocrine disruptors, and so they affect hormone receptors. And we've certainly seen in the analysis of the tissue of breast cancer survivors that individuals who have been exposed to high amounts of pesticide have that pesticide in the fatty tissue of the breast. Well, we also have fatty tissue in the brain. So as I introduce you to compounds like 5-HTP to raise serotonin, theanine to begin to raise GABA, and the use of tyrosine to raise dopamine. We're talking about three of the very simple ways that we can moderate neurotransmitters, but you know what? It's not always that simple. Assessing individuals, you know, I call it test, don't guess. The assessing of individuals is often necessary. And so whether it's blood work where we measure food sensitivities, whether it's salivary work where we're measuring hormones, or whether it's urine testing where we measure these neurotransmitters, there are lots of times when we must test, not guess. Testing is expensive. I never recommend it randomly in my practice. You know, when you're recommending a test that costs several hundred dollars, you really want to be respectful of whether you're putting the rubber to the road and you're going to get the most effect from it. But I have to tell you, I've become quite a fan of this kind of testing over the last dozen years that I've been doing it, simply because of the fact that I see such fabulous results when we address neurological testing, endocrine testing, or immune testing. Very interesting. I did a food sensitivity test on a client recently, and I use a food sensitivity testing panel that measures 120 foods and 30 chemicals. And this particular female had a lot of reactions on the chemical side of the equation, things that are fairly common in food. Everything from nitrates and nitrites that are used to preserve hot dogs and ham and lunch meat, all the way to MSG. Well, it was interesting because in the couple of months that I'd worked with her, we'd already seen that any time that she ate lunch meat, she had an untoward response. And when we found nitrites and nitrates, the preservative agents of these things, as one of her reactive foods, it was easy to understand why she reacted so violently when she had an antipasto plate at the Italian restaurant, a hot dog at the ball field, or even the deli ham and turkey meat that she had on a chef's salad, and then had a really, really lousy effect on her mood disorders and on her sleep. It would affect her sleep. She would actually even get a fever and fatigue, and it would last for several days. So those, whatever the sickness behavior is, really came from the immune challenge of the nitrates and the nitrites raising her inflammatory cytokines, and then in turn creating pro-inflammatory signaling happening in her brain. That in turn gives us the changes in the neuronal activity that presents with these clinical symptoms that are what we refer to as sickness behavior. So who'd have thunk it? Getting ham and turkey on your chef's salad make you feel lousy? Getting a hot dog at the ballpark make you feel lousy? Getting an antipasto plate at the Italian restaurant would make you feel lousy? We would have never figured it out had we not done food sensitivity testing and seen what the immune challenge was to this large family of protein messengers called inflammatory cytokines. So my function today was to bring this information to you about the fact that each of these systems affect the other systems. You whack out the hormones, it will affect the immunity. You whack out immunity, it'll affect the nervous system. You whack out the nervous system, it will affect immunity. It doesn't make any difference where you come in that circle, you can be affected. And so when we test for these things, we have to look at the house on fire. You know, I quote my father repeatedly when he says, if the house is on fire and the sink is leaking, you don't call the plumber. You deal with whatever the most provocative response is. But these food sensitivity tests, I feel, are so incredibly critical, because if you continue to put in the food that is causing the inflammation in the first place, and you don't stop using that food. And see, that food may be perfectly safe for you and trouble for me, and vice versa. I might be able to have nitrates and nitrites in lunch meat, even though I don't eat it, and not have a problem with it. But you might have a big problem with it. And that hypersensitivity could manifest as everything from a headache to a skin issue to a GI complaint to a low mood, persistent pain, you know, redness and swelling. All sorts of things can happen as a result of hypersensitivity reactions to food. So without knowing what your particular pattern is, you wouldn't be taking away the agent that's causing the problem. So maybe the agent that's causing the problem is a pesticide. Maybe it's an environmental thing. Maybe it's a pollen or a weed like the pine and oak and cedar that we'll see here in Sarasota County a month from now. The weeds that will show up in September and October when the grasses start to bloom. It's kind of a leap. And it's certainly a leap for physicians. You know, I have to realize that some of you that are regular listeners to No Nonsense Nutrition actually know more about these relationships than your physician does, because your physician has studied a specialty. So whether it's cardiology or endocrinology or urology, they've stayed in that particular track. And this is one of the things that the Institute for Functional Medicine has helped me with so much. You know, IFM, Institute for Functional Medicine, based out of Gig Harbor, Washington, has been my partner for nearly 20 years in education in these arenas. I attend many IFM events, in the dozens of them over the years. When I went back and counted it up, I'd done over 1,000 hours of education from Institute for Functional Medicine, and I'll look forward to the next event that I go to in Arizona in May. Because IFM has helped physicians and acupuncturists and chiropractors and pharmacists, nurses and nutritionists to help to understand the web-like effect of the body. There are no systems in the body that stand alone. Your skin is connected to your liver and your bowel. Your brain is connected to your nose. Your allergies are related to your hormones. There is no system that stands alone. And so until you have a clinician working with you that has a web-like approach, you'll not find a relationship. I had a lady that came to me years ago, and she had a tick in her eye. And by a tick, I mean a muscle twitch. And she sat there during the whole hour that I was doing the intake history with that eye twitching, 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 twitching. But she made no mention of it. And I have clients fill out paperwork on their symptoms before they come in for their appointment. And I looked at that list of symptoms, and she didn't mention the twitch in her eye. And we got finished with the whole hour that it takes to do a proper history. And I said, well, what about that twitch in your eye? And she said, oh, well, there's nothing you can do about that. I've had that for over 20 years. When I read her food diary, I was quite amazed to see that this woman loved ketchup. Now, I like ketchup. There's things I like to put ketchup on. But I'm telling you, this woman loved ketchup. She put ketchup on her eggs. She used ketchup as salad dressing. She put ketchup on her potatoes. She used ketchup on her pork chops. And when I suggested to her that she might have a sensitivity to tomatoes, she said that wasn't possible because she ate it all the time. And I asked her if she could eliminate the use of ketchup for a week, and she said that wasn't possible. So with the help of the wonderful cooking teacher and author Polly Pitchford, I was able to make her a beet relish that was kind of sweet and tart like ketchup is, that she was able to use as a substitute over a week. Well, she didn't last a week. She only lasted 5 days, but on the third day, the twitch in the eye stopped. And when I suggested to her that it was smart for us to do a food sensitivity test, she finally agreed. But the thing that was the most interesting to me is on the fifth day, she'd gone as far as she could. And on the sixth day, she went back and she grabbed that bottle of ketchup And she put that ketchup on her food, and 20 minutes later, her eyes started to twitch again. What we don't realize is that it wasn't just a matter of her eye twitching. It was a matter of the fact that that reaction was going through her entire immune system and in turn affecting her neurologic and nervous system. So even things that seem benign, the hot dog at the ballpark, the turkey and ham on the chef salad, the antipasto plate, the ketchup on your eggs. Anybody can be sensitive to anything.